197. That's the number of signatory to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change.
They are choking our planet.
This is code red.
Nature cannot pay the price any longer.
Each of them has their own concerns and interests, which makes reaching any consensus a huge challenge. Let's take a look at some of the main stakeholders and negotiating blocs engaged in the 2022 UN Climate Conference, COP27. China is the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitter, but the country is increasing its coal use in the face of energy security risks. And President Xi Jinping said in October that China would continue to support the clean and efficient use of coal.
China will strive to peak carbon dioxide emissions before 2030 and achieve carbon neutrality before 2060.
Geopolitics also overshadow climate issues. A diplomatic row over Taiwan led Beijing to cancel bilateral climate talks with the United States. United States is the world's second biggest emitter after China. Recent approval of domestic legislation should unlock trillions of dollars in investment in clean energy and transportation.
Yo, it's now law.
And
welcome to Global Take, America's number one podcast, where we discuss global issues from the Black perspective. It's time for our voices to be at the forefront of foreign policy. This is Alexandria Haidara, your podcast host.
I'm going to meet with Mr. Raymond Cunyu, chairman, founder, and CEO of Strahel Composites. Strahel Composite is an independent international affairs startup think tank that applies collective intelligence to assist leaders in the public and private sectors in order to make informed decisions, identify common ground, facilitate mutually beneficial connections, find sustainable solutions to global issues. We had a moment to sit down with Mr. Cunyu to reflect on his time after Egypt's COP27 and the future of climate change policies in the world and in Africa in particular.
Okay. So, yes, Mr. Raymond, do you mind discussing a little bit about your startup think tank and what brought you to COP27 conference in Egypt?
Sure. Diplomacy, and more specifically towards this climate diplomacy. So we thought that it's best to kind of involve ourselves in this due to the human-centric aspect of climate change and the consumption that's leading to these changes that we see around us, from emissions to other issues that are related to the vulnerability created as a result, of climate change itself. So Egypt makes sense. It's within Africa, not too far from the Strahel Composite is a collective intelligence organization that tries to bring the world together to solve some of the pressing issues, and also encourages the world to leave encourages the world to kind of deal with these issues now, so that we could leave a better world for the future generations. The COP27 in Egypt is one of the most important meetings, I think, out of all of them, because it is time that all the actions that have been taking place in all the previous 26 conference of party meetings to bring about some sort of sense in regards to implementation, and this is why the slogan for this meeting was gearing towards a greater sense of implementation of the climate actions, both promised and undiscussed. So the organization Nairobi, so it made sense to be involved because it's one of those global platforms that's going to illuminate the issues that are affecting us presently and in the future.
Okay. And you mentioned that your organization deals with diplomacy. Do you, like when I think of think tanks, like
council formulations? Does your organization write research papers, or how do you like influence these climate change policy discussions on the African continent?
Sure. So the role that the organization plays falls within the four pillars. So one is diplomacy, which I mentioned earlier, which is how humans relate to each other and also how sovereign states relate to each other. Two, tech and society, which is how humans interact with technology and how technology interacts with humans. Thirdly, infrastructure, which is how humans build the world, you know, so anything outside of the natural world that we received. And lastly, but definitely not least, is global business, which is how humans exchange goods, services, and information across borders. So the role that we play within the climate change policy as it relates to Africa is that we influence and inform. So influence, of course, is through engaging the stakeholders, and information is through our publishing and our consulting and advisory services. As we are a startup, we are in the stage of actually securing all the registration that we require, so that we can begin meaningful partnerships with organizations around the world that are dealing within those four pillars. So in terms of partnership for publication and so on and so forth, but also our publications will be unique in the fact that, you know, most of the people that receive these documents don't read every single word. So we've realized there's this need to synthesize information, make it short so that people can read it. So, you know, a summary report that will be 150 pages can be easily condensed to maybe 10 and get the message across, and also supplement it with the main report for the researchers like myself who like to dig through the information. And the way we will deal with this specifically is through collective action, which is why we're within the collective intelligence field, where we'll try to combine all the intelligence around climate action. Is it working? Will it work? For how long will it work? You know, so this is the sustainability aspect, and also the main argument within climate change, the adaptation versus mitigation, where some developed countries are far ahead in their development, and the fossil fuels are being found in nations that previously didn't have them, and they would like to make you know, to make the best out of it by using the funds that they'll get from it to inject it back into the
countries in the global south.
The term reparations, I tend to walk very you know, carefully around those conversations, because mm-hmm. you know, it by the suggestion of the word, you have people who are victims and people who are the aggressors. And in that sense, I try to steer clear, because climate change affects us all in the same way. It just happens that there's some who are causing more of it than others. And here you have the emissions example, where you have a lot of developing countries are producing more emissions at the expense of those who are not producing it, and yet they get to experience it more because of the lack of funding. So my version of that is the funding aspect, where it seems just, right, that those who contribute the most to it should assist those who are being affected the most by it. And that has been a great point of discussion at the meetings, where most people are discussing you know, funding and realistically, some of these funding promises have not been met. So you can say, like the recent study by the World Bank, which says that, you know, climate events will squeeze more than 132 million people into poverty worldwide. And with African countries losing between 10 to 15% of their GDP by 2050. So when you speak about how are we going to assist these nations, you know, cushion the blow that's coming ahead, because climate change is not going anywhere anytime soon. And then you have Africa producing 4% of the world's planet warming emissions, yet they make up 17% of the world's population, right? Or the promise of $100 billion a year in climate funding that we are yet to see, you know, being fulfilled. And it's been 2 years past the deadline where this pledge was made. Or, you know, just the talk around the African Development Bank, you know, estimating that, you know, the gap that needs to be closed for the continent's financial needs towards climate change is about 160 billion and I believe it was 340 billion by 2030. So all these things are coming at the same time. And this is why you're seeing a lot of a talk around the reparations. But what they really mean is exactly what I've just explained. We need you to fund something that you've created at a rapid pace. And we would also like to enjoy some of the benefits that you've enjoyed out of the fossil fuels that you found on your ground as well. So, you know, this is the adaptation and mitigation argument that comes into play again, and it's directly related to the reparations you've inquired.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, for sure, like the global issues, they're affecting all of us. But definitely there are players who are definitely more guilty than others in terms of where we are to now with the climate change. As far as like what was your impressions of COP27? Like, did you know of any African leaders? Like, were there a lot of African leaders, world leaders that were there? And like, what were the main topics? What was really on the agenda? Did you leave like the conference feeling like things were going to make, like this conference was going to be the conference to really make, to push the global north, if you will, to act more on climate change issues?
Well, to be honest, I've been skeptical of these meetings because mm-hmm. it's been 27 of them since the first one in 1995. Mm-hmm. And we are still talking about the same things that we were talking about in the first mm-hmm. meeting. Now, along the way, we have seen progress, but it's a slow progress. You know, for something that's of importance to the future, we are taking our time in arriving at the conclusion that this is going to be one of the greatest issues affecting future generations. So coming into it, I was like, okay, we are going into it. And if I'm sure you've attended a few global conferences, and they're similar in the manner that they invite all the leaders, and it's usually at a location that's far away from where the reality has struck so potently. For example, you have even the offices that these international organizations have located in spots that are far away from the decisions that will be made on behalf of the people that are being affected by these things. So when you see these meetings, you know, there's this opulence too that's associated. You know, you have wine. You know, I was looking at some of the videos, you know, but this is common within these conferences where people just meet and they have to enjoy themselves as they're trying to talk about some of these issues. So it was very interesting with this one, because what you're seeing, because it's not the first one that's been held in Africa. We've had a few others held within Africa. I think in Marrakech, it's been there twice, in Nairobi. and in Durban, South Africa. So this is nothing new to hold within Africa. And I think it's chosen in that way so that you can bring the attention to the people there. And Africa has been moving, in the world in terms of economic progress and so on and so forth. But at the same time, it's also been one of the main continents affected by these changes, yet they're not the ones contributing the most. So when you look at that, then it gives importance to this meeting. But it still has that attachment that I alluded to before, where it seems like the decisions made here are far away from the people that will be affected by those decisions. So you have that, and then you had the talk that there was need that there's a strong need to build climate infrastructure to make smart investments in terms of adaptation and mitigations. And world leaders that I saw that I felt especially within, because I think you asked African world leaders, like the ones that come to mind are His Excellency Macky Sall, who is the President of the Republic of Senegal and chairperson of the African Union, who has been a great leader in terms of climate change and what needs to be done. You had South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who is making a massive call to action as far as how vulnerable Africa is going to be and has been in terms of climate change. And Dr. Richard Muyongi, the Tanzanian who's a climate activist, a climate change diplomat, and you know, he has been a chief negotiator for Tanzania for a long time. You know, I like his points of views when it comes to this. And then you had other young activists, including Elizabeth from Kenya, and you know, ministry representatives, international organization stakeholders, like the African Climate Foundation, the UN dignitaries and representatives of the UN organs like UNICEF and UNEP. So everyone who had a stake in this, and in all honesty, everyone should have a stake in this because we are the largest contributors to climate change that we see around us, which is something that's referred in the scientific world as Anthropocene, where we are responsible for the first time in the history of the planet. We are the ones responsible for the changes that we're seeing around us, environmental and otherwise. So if we don't take it seriously, it's going to greatly affect us in a way that you can't imagine. I could give you a good example, like animals. Some of the animals that are becoming extinct as a result of this. So where you used to see tigers, they're, you know, at a zoo or something, we'll be seeing them in books in the future. They'll be like, yeah, wow. There used to be an animal called a tiger. Because some of these changes are affecting the ecosystems where these animals thrive. They're affecting where humans live. So you'll see climate migration. People will start to move as a result of heat waves. There was a good example given. There was a study done by the Rebuild for Design, I think is what they called, at the New York University, where they're suggesting the extreme heat will force a lot of people to move from where they're living. I believe there's a third, I think it's by 2050 or 2055, a third of America will be uninhabitable. Right. So when you consider these things, and they're happening gradually, they're leading towards these things, then the concern of where we're heading and what we are doing to alleviate some of these problems is growing and growing. And at its exponential reach, we will find ourselves with no planet to live if we don't take it seriously. You know, if you live on this side of the world, and in big cities, you're far removed from that reality because most of the time you get inside a car and you drive to work. Yeah. The only exposure you've got to nature is the walk between your car in the parking lot to the building that you're getting in. So you never see anything. You never see the ground. You know, you would sooner notice a crack inside the walls of your office or your home than you would on the ground, right? Because you don't think about that, because that's not what you're exposed to. I hike a lot, so I've seen the changes personally, you know, especially the New England area in Africa and Kenya. So I've gotten to see these changes with my own eyes. So when I speak passionately about it, it's because I have seen these changes. And it's amazing that some of the experts within the field, you meet them and you ask them, it's like the first time that they've realized that there's this. I'll give you an example. I was hiking recently in the New England area.
And, I like hiking myself, so.
And I ran into a surveyor, and I think he was checking the levels of the water. And prior to me getting to where he was, I had noticed there's a section where water used to rise during springtime, and it was empty. And I asked him, is that what's going on? And his response was, he didn't even know there used to be water there, yet he's measuring the levels of the water. So that tells me that we are far removed from the reality. Either we have an attention deficit, where we are not paying attention to these changes, or we are too inundated with so many other issues that are a result of modernity, that we don't pay attention to the ground. Both literally and figuratively. Wow. So, you know, my one of the first things that I've realized as a result of Anthropocene is that we need to expose ourselves to our planet so that we can understand it. And most of us are not. Most of us are not.
We're just so wrapped up in our jobs and careers and commuting from, you know, school practice to work to back at home. And then, you know, speaking of that, I used to live in Rwanda, and, you know, it's a very modern country, modern African country, if you will. They're really rebranding themselves. And when you go there, you see all these new skyscrapers. Marriott International was there. They're building a lot of new hotels for the guerrilla tourism industry. You know, they're developing the country the way the West is developing itself. When you look at places like New York City or Washington, D.C., like when you see these new development projects, it's like bigger buildings, more apartments. And one man, one Rwandan that I met there said that, you know, we're developing Africa like the West, and we can't keep up with that. Like, because those buildings require air conditioning, they require electricity, they require strong water sanitation system. So what do you see in terms of like our economic system, how Africa's developing? Do you see it is contributing to this climate change issue, or like, are they changing the way they're developing their country to adapt to these new climate change that's affecting the continent, or they're just copying what they see the West doing and implementing it in the country?
I would say it's a bit of both, right? So you have, you know, there's some good things that can be emulated or copied, right? Like, you know, architectural designs. You can copy these things, you know, in your way, but what you can't copy are the local tendencies, right? I can't speak for Rwanda specifically, but let me speak of an example in an area that I explored, which is the Great Rift Valley. When you go to when you go to Lake Naivasha in Kenya, and Lake Nakuru, these great lakes of the Great Rift Valley, you'll notice part of the ecosystem has changed as a result of either swelling waters or receding waters. And what this has done, if you, let's say, in the time that I went to Lake Naivasha, I recall there's a small town called Kihoto that's within the fringes of the lake, within the shores. And when the water flooded and it extended over a kilometer and a half inland, all those houses were flooded, all of them. So if that was your livelihood, that's where you stored your clothes, you'll have to uproot yourself and move yourself to a different place. So when you speak about, you know, what do we need to do? In this case, you need to come up with architecture that fits the environment, right? If you look at the meadowlands in Florida, they rise their buildings. So they raise them off the ground, right? You have these pillars that support the foundation, you know, kind of like the oil rigs. And you build your house on top so that when the water comes in, the water goes below your house, not, and it doesn't destroy your house. So I think that's one of the localized. And as I witnessed this, I asked the locals and the fishermen that I was with, why doesn't this happen here? And they're saying because they never thought the water will come in. If any body of water was within a certain geographical area, it is bound to return, whether by cause of rain or underground reservoirs. So when you build certain things, you know, you have to consider that. It's kind of like you wouldn't build your house in a swamp, right? And if you did, then you would have to you'll have to either get those pillars and then, you know, build a platform on which your house will stand, and then maybe build lakes. And the Dutch are great experts at this. The Italians, where they build where they build cities around water, and I think these are some of the things that could be copied or emulated, that can also fit the local, because the problems are usually similar. So if you base your solutions on similarity of problem rather than actualization or materialization of the building, then you begin to understand what kind of building you require or what kind of changes you need to bring to your local area in order for it to fit the future that you'd want. And I think this long-term vision needs to be within every African nation, where you think ahead because you've done your work within the area where you want to build or you want to alleviate. You know, when you speak about the Horn of Africa, how is the Horn of Africa having food shortages, right? And there's food surplus in Congo and in some areas in Kenya, especially the ones around the mountain. And it's because the food distribution infrastructure is very poor, where you have people are throwing food away because they have no one to sell it to. Oh, and then on the other hand, you have people who are starving and they need that food, and you can't reconcile those two because of distance and the infrastructure and the lack of infrastructure to make sure that distribution happens. I remember there was someone who even boldly said, I cannot trace it in my memory, but I remember exactly what was said. And it was that if you irrigate and grow crops within the Central African region, it can feed the whole of Africa. Such a small region, yeah, can feed the whole of Africa. So we are looking at this the wrong way. And this is what I mean by, you know, using both. You can copy, you can emulate, but also try to think of, we actually have the power to feed ourselves, but we are not building the infrastructures to do it.
Do you see African leaders like coming out of COP27? Are they doing anything to address these climate change issues, like, you know, given the rise in floods and the massive droughts, and even like you said, feeding African can feed itself. I know there's like different types of seeds that are adaptive to the new climate change dynamic that we're experiencing. Are you seeing African leaders playing a role in like restructuring their infrastructure to make sure that we don't have food insecurity in a region, and making sure that their policies are adapted to the climate change going forward?
Yes, you're seeing this, especially within the African Trade Agreement, AFTA, which is trying to, you know, it's attempting to, you know, to bring some of these issues to the fore and also dealing with them, where you want more trade between African nations. So this will inspire infrastructure building. and capacity building, where you can distribute food on a large scale because you understand there's a surplus here. We need it, so you can buy it. So, you know, nations will start incentivizing other nations to do the same. And also the Agenda 2063, which is a long-term vision of where we would like to see Africa in the future. So leaders are subscribing to these ideals of where we would like to see ourselves in the future. And I think, you know, most nations are 50, 60 years removed from independence. So they're beginning to realize their power. They're beginning to realize what they can do and what they can't do. And the one thing has been abundantly clear is that in order for us to move forward, we have to start working together. And by doing that, we can mitigate some of these changes. And we're also dealing with migration within the realm of climate change as a result of the changes that we're seeing. So that too can be dealt with. So when you begin with the trade agreement, then you're facilitating that, because unemployment will become an issue where it's not an issue already. The distribution of the population will change too. Africa has a young population, so the young would like to inherit a better future. So you're seeing a lot of activism within that. And there's this bridge that people are trying to build. And I think this is why Egypt was chosen, because Egypt, if you look at the location of Egypt, it's like it forms a bridge, you know, between the eastern side and the western side. So it made sense to kind of pick them as a location for doing this, more specifically the city that was chosen. And so these are suggestions that we do want to work together. And by doing that, we are prompting action from other nations, and that has been seen a lot within this one. I think it's the first time I can say that I've witnessed a strong, aggressive, response from the African nations and their respective institutions in terms of what can you do for us moving forward? Because you've pledged, you've not met your pledges, you've promised this, you've not fulfilled them, and we would like to see that happen in the future. So if you're young and you're watching this, then it gives you confidence, because you can build on that as time goes on, and with confidence comes action. And I'm hopeful that some of these things will come to be in our lifetime. Yeah,
for sure. I mean, like when you think about and you mentioned him before, President Macky Sall of Senegal, like in terms of like the leadership that's needed to make change, he was stating that rich nations need to bear responsibility for the crisis and they should pledge $200 billion a year to the Global South. Do you see the African Union pushing this idea, the COP27, or was it just all talk and no action?
No, it's been pushed. In fact, it was one of the agenda items, mm-hmm. Climate financing. And climate financing will be important for the reasons that we alluded to earlier when you spoke about reparations and funding. And it's true, Macky pressed for this, and he, I think his pressure has been met with response, because you have things that have happened within deliverables within the COP27 that suggested, for example, the joint work program of the UNFCCC technology mechanism, which was launched at this COP27, and this it's a new joint work program of the technology mechanism that covers work between 2023 and 2027. So I guess we'll learn more about it as more meetings will be held. I believe the next COP will be held in UAE, the United Arab Emirates. So we'll see some of these deliverables, because this has just been agreed. So we'll see it broken down, but it includes roadmaps, technology roadmaps, work on gender and technology and NDCs and digitalization, and common areas of work for for meeting some of these things that we're seeing. And also the United States, you know, announced a contribution of $3 million to support the implementation of the joint work program. Another climate financing aspect was there's the Adaptation Fund, which has, it's a good alternative to what the UNFCCC is putting together, and has been met with great reception from all the countries that have contributed. And the amount that they contributed is also vast enough to suggest that we are taking climate financing seriously. Again, a heed to the call that His Excellency Macky Sall made before. And then you have the GEF funds to the least developed countries and to the least developed countries fund and the Special Climate Change Fund, which target climate vulnerable states, and most of which are located within the small islands and the developed nations, Africa and Southeast Asia, that especially on the African side of things.
Oh, I see. You know, it sounds like you're pretty optimistic on the outcomes of COP27. Like, it sounds like the West, like you said, the United States pledging $3 million towards climate finance projects. And so did you see that at least the African Union, like what was their platform and what were some of the issues you think that they should play in the future in terms of like the future COP, COP28, for example?
Right. They, like I said, I think it's the first time I witnessed the aggressiveness from the activists, the young African activists and the organizations. So with this going into the next COP meetings, I think when you feel like they've been held for so long and little action has been done, you'll see one of two things or both happening simultaneously. One, you'll see nations receding from these meetings, right? Like they will just walk away because we've tried it all these many times and we're not seeing change. Or you'll see them becoming more aggressive and asking for their accountability processes and the transparency processes. You'll also see alternative funding. So you'll see a move away from these international bodies, and you'll see private companies doing it, and you've seen it too, in some respect, as far as donating towards these funds. Some of it has come from individuals and also corporations. So more stakeholders need to come into the conversation, because it's not just us. Humans occupy institutions, right? We occupy, corporations, we occupy non-governmental organizations, and at the same time, we are affecting the planet. So we should not be removed from these institutions whose positions we assume, because they too are causing. When you think of manufacturing, it takes power, energy to do that. When you think of transportation, you have cars that are moving, people need to move, they need oil to move. So we should involve these people into it. So those who seem like enemies as far as contributing towards this need to be on the table too. And I think when you speak of collective action, this is what Strata Composite is about, because there's a point for everyone to contribute as far as the direction that we're heading towards with the climate changes that we see around us. So African countries will take one of those two routes, or they'll do it simultaneously. And I would like to think that the simultaneous action will be good, because you're keeping pressure and at the same time, you're creating some of your own. So, that's the outlook I would like to witness as far as the participation of African countries in the future conference of party meetings.
And that does it for us on Global Take, where we discuss global issues from the Black perspective. If you enjoyed this episode, please like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. You can find us at Black Professionals and International Affairs at www.iabpia.org. You can also find all podcasts on Spotify as well as Apple Podcasts. So please like and leave a comment. Thank you.